This program was funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with the television licence fee.
It has been a real pleasure working as a pirate, even though we broke the law. But we've made the law as well. Because we changed the law. Only for the likes of pirate radio, we wouldn't be anywhere where we are now.
Hello, I'm Justin Ma. I'm the programme director of Community Radio Yall. Since 1995, our station has been a licensed community broadcaster serving Yall Town and the surrounding rural areas. But this station started way before that. It goes all the way back to 1979, a time when the pirates ruled the airwaves, and a group of young men were inspired by the nation's broadcaster to join the club.
Pirate stations were being set up and to an extent ignored by the authorities. And while it might sound a bit Wild West and all that, we had no fear, so we just went for it.
It was a time when you couldn't buy a radio station, you had to build it.
Did you ever see any of those films with Dr. Frankenstein? He was going to his laboratory. You could hear the bzz, bzz. That's what it was like up there. There was jam pots and bits of wire going into bottles and clubs.
And these young men wanted to provide a voice to their community.
We wanted to rope in the entire town of all ages. Of all ages. And that was very important.
Today, we broadcast from purpose-built studios with office space and meeting rooms. But this station wasn't born in an office. It wasn't born in a studio. It was born in an upstairs attic.
Good morning to everybody in Yall, and indeed you in the surrounding areas. This is Rosalind Hughes speaking, introducing our very own programme, Women in Yall. With me in the studio this morning, I have Mrs. Diana Dair, who will speak to us on her memories of Yall and past life. Mrs. Adair is by no means a newcomer to RTE. You may remember she appeared on the Late Late Show some time back and gave a very interesting discussion on her large selection of parrots.
In the middle of the 1970s, RTE began experimenting with bringing radio to communities outside of the major cities. By June of 1979, that experiment had reached Yall in East Cork, and for a week, RTE set up a transmitter and broadcast to the town. Its presenters would be local people, talking about local issues and showcasing local talent. The week was a huge success and was met with great enthusiasm from the people of the town, as Barty Murphy, a member of the local coordinating committee, recalls.
It was electric. There was double parking on both sides in front of the Mall House. And people loved turning on the radio and listening to voices they knew and music that they wouldn't hear on other stations. And I was the secretary. I was organising who was going in next and all that crack. And all clubs' representatives went on in the air. There was nobody turned away.
There was an incredible reaction to the mobile unit. We tried to pack as much as possible into the week, and very quickly we got the feeling that the people wanted more of it.
Tony Hannan presented a programme during RTE's week-long broadcast.
The week coincided with the local elections, and as the results came out, they came into the unit and I managed to interview everyone who got elected and maybe some of the ones who didn't. It never dawned on me anything about radio until it happened. It whetted the appetite for not alone us as presenters, but really the people of Yall as well.
And we hope through our training that we can provide this.
I see. And Michael, you say a training section. What do you mean by this?
Well, our association, which is CBSI, has a particular aim, and it's to develop the spiritual, moral, cultural and physical aspects of our members to make them a good, honest Catholic in society. That's basically what our aim is. Through our
Noel Cronin was also involved in the RT initiative and had a keen interest in radio.
This was set up, you see, to combat the pirates. It was packaged and sold, the idea of RT reaching out to the small communities and enhancing radio. Because you must remember, RT was very far down in the pecking order of radio stations then. You had in Dublin, you had huge stations like Radio Dublin, ARD, Radio Nova. But it blew back in RT's face because it gave everyone a taste. And everywhere the community radio wagon went, usually there was a pilot radio set up about a couple of weeks after that.
And now we have Mr. Jackie Brooks with For Your Listening Pleasure.
Thank you very much, Bernadette. And if you're going to bring your family into it, I better thank Carmel and tell her to not to burn the spuds or anything while I'm on now. And would you like to stay with me for a while?
Oh, I'd love to.
Well, stay as long as you like. I'd be delighted to have you, literally holding my hand, if you would, please.
RT packed up their outside broadcast unit and headed out of town on the Saturday evening. But they had given inspiration to a group of young men who would look to fill the vacuum.
The silence in the mall was deafening. There was nobody around. And all the action was gone. All the RT men were gone as well. So there was a O'Loughlin's shop, and I was looking in the window with my hands in my pockets, saying to myself, God, that was great. So I says to Tony, Anthony Hannon, I says, Tony, would you be interested in starting a radio station? He says, I would, yeah. We better have a chat with Noel Cronin. He'd be the man that would know all the technicalities of it.
Pirate radio stations were springing up everywhere by the late 70s. The law regarding illegal broadcasting, the Wireless Telegraphy Act of 1926, lacked any serious penalties and was sluggishly enforced. For Noel Cronin, it presented an opportunity.
We said, look, they're getting away with it in Cork City. They're getting away with it in Waterford. They're getting away with it. Around that time, there was a lull in the raids, even. So things were nice and quiet. We said, look, we chance it.
Tony Hannon.
The situation in Ireland at the time was that there was really only one or two national radio stations, principally RT, and there was no commercial local stations like, let's say, Red FM. None of those existed. And there was certainly no community stations either. So pirate stations were being set up and to an extent ignored by the authorities. And while it might sound a bit Wild West and all that, we had no fear, so we just went for it.
One of the first people recruited for the project was Conor O'Reilly, who had just finished his leaving cert.
What I do remember was the level of enthusiasm with everybody. You know, no problem was too big. Do we have a transmitter? No. Asher, we'll build one. You know, do we have an aerial? No, but sure, we'll build an aerial. Do we have a studio? No, but sure, we'll get somewhere. It wasn't that, oh, that's going to knock us back. It's how do we get around it? How do we get under it? How do we get over it? How do we surmount it? And the enthusiasm and the drive to get the job done.
There were two main obstacles to overcome in setting up Community Radio Youghal: a place to house a studio and the equipment needed for broadcast. Fortunately, there was one man already in their midst that would be key to both. Noel Cronin, who had already set up a radio station in Youghal back in the early 70s as a teenager.
Now, we're here in my garage in the Golflings Road, and this is the exact site, I suppose, when radio first made its appearance here in Youghal, and it was radio 310 metres. I made up a small transmitter, and we set up the kitchen table from inside, plonked it out here in the centre of the garage, set up the transmitter in the workshop underneath and ran a lead out here to an amplifier, and off we went. We were limited.
From a very early age, Noel had a keen interest in electronics.
I grew up with it. Some people have blood in their veins, more people have alcohol in their veins. I have electrons in my veins, I suppose. My father was called Shocks because he worked in the ESB. He was his supervisor. He was the go-to man here in the ESB here in Youghal since 1950 right up to 1974. He was called Shocks. There was three of us, and my eldest brother, Eamon, was called Big Shocks. Middle fella was called Little Shocks, and I was called Baby Shocks, because I was the youngest. Eamon went to Sligo, and Tighe went down to Tralee, and yours truly stayed here. The other two names dropped, and I got the name Shocks. Shocks by nature, shocking by trade.
From the point of view of electronics and technology, he is an absolute genius, and has been ever since he was a little boy.
Pat Barry was a volunteer with Community Radio Youghal during its pirate days.
He might not have the correct and proper piece of equipment, but Noel could improvise. Something else could be made to fit the bill, and it wouldn't have existed without him. Not a hope.
Now, this is my little workshop. Right? This is where everything is assembled. See? And this is where we construct all our little bits and pieces and, you know, tobacco tins and things like that and little circuits here and there, you see. This is where it all actually happens, inside in this place. The very first transmitter I built was around 1973, I'd say, 72, 73. It was a very basic unit. When we started talking about community radio, it was a case of down here night after night, making up one for the radio enough event.
Noel still holds on to a lot of the equipment from Community Radio Yule's pirate days, including the station's first homemade mixing console.
When we started in Conley's attic, this was inside in the attic. And it wasn't sitting on the floor, it was sitting in two brackets that were bolted into the wall. And it's very simple underneath. Oh, jeepers, it was. Yeah. See, that's all it is underneath, look. You have two motors for the turntables, and your mains in, auxiliary mains out there, and your two controls here out onto the thing. The turntables, they're actually what's called a Garrard turntable, and they were used practically in every record player that was made by Pi around the maybe the late 50s, early 60s. It was a very, very common deck, a very, very good deck. Each of those, I would imagine, would have played a million records. So much so that the spindles in the motor actually wore down from use.
Tony Hannan found Noel's work to be impressive.
We had no money, so everything was done on a shoestring, and he had to create a studio with the most basic of equipment. It was amazing the way he put things together, you know, without question.
With the equipment taken care of, a home for the fledgling radio station was the next essential needed. The Connollys, family friends of Noel Cronin, had a location high on the hill overlooking Yule that would be ideal. In 2014, Eileen Connolly spoke to Community Radio Yule about her family's donation of their upstairs attic.
I was in town doing my shopping, and when I came home, my husband was walking up and down the front, very pensive and smoking his pipe, and he said, "You'll kill me." So I said, "For what?" He said, Noel is going to have a radio. He said, "Up in the loft." So I said, "A radio? How do you mean a radio?" "A radio station," he said, "to be transmitted." He was explaining it to me. So I said, "Oh my God, isn't that wonderful? That's great, isn't it?" He thought I didn't want it. So he came over and put his arms around me and he said, "Thank you. That's great. I'm delighted. It'll put a bit of life into the place," he said.
Seamus Murphy is a former station manager of Community Radio Yule and one of the station's earliest volunteers.
The Connollys were outstanding. How they tolerated us, I just don't know, because there were so many people going in and out of there at the time, you know. We were lucky in a way, we were sheltered, and we had good people in the Connollys that supported us fully throughout the whole lot. A lot of people would have been very, very cagey about taking on that operation, particularly when it was illegal. But the Connollys welcomed us with open arms, and we would be forever grateful for their generosity.
Community Radio Yule began broadcasting as a pirate radio station on the 4th of July 1979, and its goal was to do something very different from most pirate radio stations around the country. Nikki Parker volunteered with Community Radio Yule from 1979 to 1985.
The one thing I remember about the original jingle of CRY was bringing the people together. From the very word go, the very concept of community was in the minds of the people, obviously, brought it together. There was an effort from the very start to bring people in and provide a platform whereby news and happenings of organisations were aired. It was a pirate station, but this was a pirate station with a difference.
And with me today, I have four of the councillors which you heard. Dick Power, who's the chairman. Welcome, Dick.
Thank you, Tony.
Tommy Connell, who headed the poll on the day. Welcome, Tommy. Jack Dempsey, who first time elected and came third on the particular occasion in the local elections.
Hello.
And finally, Paddy Linehan, who, as I understand, is 25 years in the council and is the joint longest serving member. Is that true, Paddy?
That's right, Tony. 25 years.
Yeah.
Tony Hannan.
I think the content is really critical. Community radio cannot be just playing records. It has to have local content. And we were much more interested in tackling local issues and points of information about local clubs and activities and so on. And remember, we were all involved in local clubs. So really, that was really the driving force behind what we were doing.
Now, the council, when I was interviewing them, said that they have no responsibility for the allocation of houses and that it lies entirely with these health inspectors who come around and actually look at every one of the flats. Now, Breda has what I would call an amazing story to tell us about the time the health inspectors came to look at her flat.
The health inspectors called to me one day and I was in the flat and they knocked on the door and they examined the flat and talked to me about the conditions I was living in. During the time I was talking to them, I mentioned that my father was a farmer in Killa, and they said to me, why didn't I build a house out in Killa? But to tell you the truth, Tony, I find it hard enough to pay the flat, never mind build a house out in Killa.
Sure, yeah, and I mean, everyone knows, even the credit squeeze is on.
The fledgling station was committed to highlighting the issues that face their community and quickly devised programmes that would give a voice to the people of the town. As Noel Cronin recalls.
There was one such programme which I thought was very, very far ahead of its time, was Ken Smith. And what he used to do, he used to go around to different estates, you know, like Dermot Hurley, Blackwater Heights, Seafield Estate, and he'd maybe call to one house up and say, look, I'm coming up doing a radio programme in your kitchen. Invite all the neighbours in for a cup of tea. Sit them around the table, ask him what problems are they encountering in the state, what could be done to promote the town, the unemployment situation in the town, various topical issues like that. It really epitomised community radio, so it's basically parish pump radio, bringing radio right into the estates. Ahead of its time it was.
Yeah, but they will boast then, of course, that, and maybe they're right in this, that the number of houses they have built are far higher than any other town that they could mention.
But, well, we're not particularly interested in the council's activities in any other town. I mean, this is our town and this is where we're worried about the council here. And as far as I'm concerned, they're not doing enough.
But yet they say it's their main priority.
Well, if that's their main priority, I wish they'd do a little bit more about it.
Yeah.
But it wasn't just adults that community radio you all looked to cater for.
Eleanor O'Brien used to produce a children's programme on a Saturday morning, and she used to have a couple of young people that are here with us today in telling jokes and stories, kind of a kids' programme basically. This particular programme of Saturday morning had a huge audience, and the reason, it was very simple, you had no kids' television in Saturday mornings. You would know the station doing a kids' programme. I don't know of any other station that was doing a children's programme on a Saturday morning, any other pirate station, but this is a huge audience.
Yvonne Smith was 9 years old when she took part in Eleanor O'Brien's programme.
We were called the Rhymers. And then Michael Lyons was the comedian and he would tell jokes. And Eleanor would sit there mouthing to laugh and we would have to go, ha, 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 can laugh live. There you are, children laughing. And that was it really. And we did that for months on a Saturday morning. She had an absolute passion for drama and people expressing themselves. She had the kindest heart and she would encourage you. She'd always say, that's great, you're fabulous. She always told us we were fantastic. We thought we were absolutely wonderful saying these rhymes because she always told us we were. And she was just a really lovely lady. I think they were trying to bring things to the community that they felt weren't there and make it a community effort. I think they were trying to give people something that they felt was missing. They did as much as they could do, given what they were working with. It was actually amazing, really, to be able to put out stuff like that.
Barty Murphy.
To inform and entertain, that was our motto. And we wanted to rope in the entire town of all ages, and that was very important. People talk about pirates. Pirates, when you look at the films, there'd be a ship full of gold or silver or whatever to be on board, or coffee, and the pirates would spot them and they'd take over the ship. Now, the airwaves were free, so the pirates then took over the vacancies. So we didn't like to be called pirates. We were a community radio station.
Getting to know you, getting to know all about you.
The first major success for the station was a series of programmes recorded on location at pubs and community centres around East Cork and West Waterford. Pa and Nooch on tour.
Getting to know you, putting it my way, but nicely.
Welcome to Community Radio Y'all, and tonight's programme of Pa, Nooch and Tour comes from the famous pair of John and Peggy Keevers here in Ardmore. And our signature tune, Getting to Know You, is what this programme is all about. But before we get to know too many more people here at Keevers tonight...
Seamus Murphy remembers the series.
It started out with Pa Coney and Nooch. And then when Pa Coney packed it up, the late Paddy Mulcahy. And they were just touring around the pubs. And they were just get characters that could sing, somebody playing a bit of music, local sports stars that would go back in time and tell a few stories about where they were born and when they played and how much they won and everything. Hugely popular. They were the things that people defined the station by.
Pat Barry.
Pa and Nooch on tour involved the community and drew the community into the work of the radio station. And these were groundbreaking in their own way because it was moving out and moving into the community. And the appreciation which the people had for that was tremendous. It made the people of the town part of the radio. And I'm not aware of any other radio station, commercial or otherwise, doing that type of thing at that time.
And of course I'm talking to a man that has won an All-Ireland medal in minor for Cork last year, 1979. I'm talking none other than Tony Coyne, ladies and gentlemen. Tony, forget about the All-Irelands now for a while. We'll go back to when you were playing on the 14. Would you tell us something about when you really started in competitive hurling?
I think first year we won the under 14 championship, we beat Middleton. And we won there for 2 years running. And
the programme was the idea of William Kennefic, better known around Y'all as Nooch. Nooch was brought into Community Radio Y'all by Tony Hannan.
It was quite evident straight away that this was a very bright man with a natural talent. And so it proved, and he has proved to be one of the key figures really in the development of the station. He was ahead of the posse all the time about what would make a programme interesting and of value. And I think it was that cleverness and intelligence that he had that really was the standout thing. He maybe portrayed himself as just a bit of fun and it was all crack, but Nooch was always thinking ahead. That's the way it proved in every programme. He then came up with Pa and Nooch on tour. He interviewed a wide variety of people. He did a Sunday morning programme, I think, for years. And again, they were all his ideas. To me, he was one of the major successes of the thing.
Well, we continue our visit here in Ladies Bridge to the Detached Tin by saying hello to one of East Cork's most famous bachelors, Willie John Welsh. Hello, Willie John.
Thank you very much, George. Thank you very much.
Willie John, I'd like to ask you, why you never got married anyway. I'd like to ask you that question. Why
No one would ever bother with me. Simple as that.
But there was someone there from Knockmalea, I think, that you...
I got rid of her, like, because... So there I made a fool of myself, and I should be in a desperate state. But I'll sing the song about her, though I'll tell her that for nothing.
Nooch's natural broadcasting talent would impress a young Conor O'Reilly.
I can remember, I think it was out in Clashmore one time doing a programme, and I remember doing the recording, being fascinated by the way he was able to draw stories from people by making it so one-on-one and so intimate, even though we were sitting in a pub, and just to latch on to a little detail and then get them to expand on that, and what might have been a little inconsequential detail in the initial interview suddenly turned out to be the centrepiece of a really fascinating interview that would have gone on for 10 or 15 minutes. And he was just one of those people who had a presence that relaxed you immediately.
Paddy, we go back to that doom year that you were talking about there, 1926.
Yeah.
Tell us what affected that in Yarl.
Oh, it put an awful lot of money around, because over in our yard, as we call it, Buttermore's Yard, they were an English company, George Tabor of London. They came over, and I think there was as many as 12 women employed there salting down sprats, and there was a lot of men employed battling sprats. There were 7 nets fishing in Yarl at that time. And then after that, it was back to the poverty again. Sometime around then, I'm sure the dole came out, 5 bob a week, I think it was. Yarl was poverty-stricken.
Yeah.
People were hungry. Mm. And as a matter of fact, come this time of the year, you'd hear all the fishermen saying, and their dependents, the gold mine won't be long until open.
Until open, yes. Yeah.
The gold mine, the fishermen.
And the lads would be down for the bounty.
£2 bounty.
£2.
You'll get a sort of license for 10 bob, and you might as well have a flour bag.
Jim Coleman worked alongside Nooch Kennefic for over 20 years.
Nooch was a gift to work with. I love working with Nooch. He put out some wonderful programmes and he had some wonderful guests, and he had the gift of the gab. Like, you know, he talked the bird off a bush. There was one with Nooch and his late wife, Agnes. There was a big laugh. He got this letter. I play this for my wife, Agnes, the best wife, the best mother, the best everything. And he said, "Dean, Ag, I can hardly read your writing." Cry, cry, cry,
cry, cry, cry, cry, cry. Community Radio. The station's volunteers had quickly realised that they needed to go out into the community. They would take it a step further when Noel Cronin would use his technical expertise to devise and build a portable transmitter that could be carried around town to provide live broadcasting from the heart of the community.
The transmitter itself consisted of a CB radio. They were very, very popular at the time. This actually was worked off a 12-volt car battery. The actual transmitter itself was in a backpack, and there was a plastic box in the back, and you had to put it over your shoulders, and there was a big high area load of it, and a microphone. Now you can imagine the weight of a car battery on your back, and this little transmitter in beside it. No matter how much you padded it, like, everybody was complaining about the weight of this thing. By the time you're finished, you definitely had straight shoulders after it. One of the first outside broadcasts, incidentally, was the Eucharistic procession that was done here in Yarl, and we covered that. I think the time of the demise of the railway, actually, we used to go down the Strand and do a couple of vox pops. Can you imagine somebody walking towards you now with this thing, like a big 10-foot aerial out at the top of it, and a car battery in the back, and somebody walking over to putting out a microphone and asking a question, like, people must thought this fella's out from outer space. He was half stoned or something like that, half mad or something like that, which we were as much of the time, but there you are.
But while the advantages of having a roving transmitter were great, it would challenge those who had to carry it around, as Conor O'Reilly recalls.
It was like the old-fashioned whiplash aerial, so it extended up for anything up to 15 feet. And every time that you would come towards a ESB power line or a telephone line going across the street, you had to bend down. And of course, with the weight being what it was, you couldn't bend backwards because you'd topple over. So you had to bend forwards. But because the aerial was so high, you had to commence the bend forwards about 20 feet before you got to the line that was crossing the street. So you had to bend down almost double with this enormous weight on your back, stagger forward for 20 or 25 feet, and Noel or Barty would be looking at you and they'd say, yeah, we're past the line, you can straighten up now. And I'm there bent double looking at these going, you know, you try and straighten up now with this thing. It was like Quasimodo with a bag of potatoes on your back. You were bent in and crushed into this position. So eventually you came upright, staggered another few feet, and then, oh, another line, you have to bend down and go through the whole process again. So the hardest part of being a technical assistant back in those days was outside broadcasting and trying to navigate all these overhead lines.
We were going down Strand Street, I think, and you got caught in the overhead wires and burned off half of it. And of course you can imagine the scene.
solemn situation, and we were usually just behind the canopy where the Blessed Sacrament was being carried. And I think it was somewhere around Strand Street, and of course there were bare wires at the time, and this thing got caught, and there was a shower of sparks and a bang, and it was molten aluminium came down top, it burnt the top off the aerial. But we were lucky in the sense that we were coming up to the good part of the signal. We didn't need the height. It was pretty primitive, but it worked. It worked, it worked, it worked.
Seamus Murphy.
But the receiving side of it was even more interesting, because the receiver that we were using was an old ship's radio from the old Innisfallon that used to travel between Cork and Swansea, the old cross-channel ferry Innisfallon. You couldn't take your eyes off it for a second. There was a big dial on it that you would have to catch with your wide-open palm. It was a big, big dial. And what happened was, if you took your eye off it for about 5 seconds, it would stray and you'd lose the signal. So you had to watch it consistently. It was kind of primitive-like, but by God, it done the job, though. We never even imagined that we'd be able to do anything like that. You'd be thinking at that stage, Jesus, anything is possible. That opened new horizons for us. And then Noel bought the little van then. That then opened up a totally new horizon altogether, because we were able to go over to places like Clashmore, Ardmore, Castlemartre, Killa for matches and things like that. So the backpack was the forerunner to all of this. I can't even imagine going through it again. To be just priceless. Your memories you'll never lose, you know.
Jim Flanagan's Centra Food Store North, Main Street, Yall, offer quality own brand products as well as all the top brand names. Centra Cheese Slices, 59 pence. Centra Minerals, 1.5 litres for 65 pence. Centra Orange Juice, 59 pence. Centra.
The strong connection that Community Radio Yall had formed with the people of the town extended to businesses as well. Advertising revenue would allow the station to sustain itself and plan future development. Seamus Murphy is a former station manager of Community Radio Yall.
We had a huge core of advertisers at the time. I can't think of any business in town that didn't advertise with us, to be quite honest. And a lot of them were regular at the time. Concure's auctioneers, Michael T. Murphy, Cal Flavin, all of those, and more with them. The list goes on and on. And they were regular with us from the day we opened until the day we closed. On top of that, you'd get advertising in then from a bit further afield. We started getting advertising in from places like Castlemartre, a little bit from Middleton here and there. So that gave us a bit more leeway. There was no fundraising. Nobody coming up and saying, here's €100 or here's €10,000 for you. It was purely advertising and nothing else.
Conkeel, the old auctioneer, is selling the following property at present. At Lowermoyne Mill Hill, a newly reconstructed and renovated and modernised townhouse, an ideal location on level ground and central to all services. The Priory, North Main Street, ideal as a souvenir stationery shop. This is one of the town's most famous historic sites. Upperwine Mill Hill, a large family home on an elevated site with a fantastic view of the harbour and town.
Barty Murphy was responsible for canvassing businesses for advertising.
It was decided at a committee level that the ad man had access to the live broadcast, provided there was a record on. So I went into Mary Kennedy's and Bernie Kennedy's, and I went in there for a £2 ad. I says, I'll have it on to you next 5 minutes. So when the record was playing here, I went in and I put it on the ad sheet and I gave it to the person to read it out. And I went back down to Mary and I collected a £2 offer. And she says, I'll have another one. So it was a £4 deal.
When confronted by miles and piles of bland brands, knock the lot. Go for the best and get it for less at L&N Superstores. Shelf after shelf, L&N Superstores are chock full of household names you know and trust. Like
Seamus Murphy recalls how one of the major retailers in town supported the station.
The L&N were a pretty big chain at that time. They were probably as big as Super Value were now. And L&N used to provide their own adverts for us. But then after a while, they just provided the backing track. They wanted the ads to be more localised, whereby if they had any special offers locally, they would be able to include them. In fact, we also ended up doing their in-house ads for the shop. We had a long, long, long association with L&N. They stayed with us right up until the last day.
But it wasn't just businesses that were keen to get on the airwaves.
We would like in the Labour Party that people would examine our policies, our social and economic programme,
This, I think, is the best way to judge elections or to judge parties. But notwithstanding that, I believe that the people of Yall will cross party lines and come out and give me a personal vote.
Noel Cronin.
First person on air was Tony Hannan, and he introduced the chairman of Yall UDC, the late Dick Power. And we came on the 4th of July 1979 at 11:30. And big introduction, Cayley music, and we came. And I remember the words of Dick Power. He says, "I'm delighted to be opening this radio station." He says, "This is the best thing that happened in Yall since the sliced pan." And at the time, there was a kind of a culture. Asha, look, even with the pirates, look, they're doing no harm. They're fulfilling a need. And what kind of copper fastened then is, around that time of the 76, 77, 78, there was a myriad of local elections and national elections. And of course, every politician jumped on the bandwagon of a pirate radio. We weren't alone bending the law, because every politician out there was bending the law as well.
But with a bright new economy and a good efficient government under Garrett Fitzgerald, we will quickly resolve these problems. I myself devote a lot of time in the Dáil and in my capacity as chairman of the Fisheries Committee of the Council of Europe to the fishing industry. We are presently involved in working out a proper Irish zone.
Seamus Murphy.
We started getting councillors taking an interest in what was going on and coming on air. We were a little bit sceptical up to that about dealing with the various civic authorities because of the fact that we were pirate. And then when we started to see councillors coming on air and giving interviews, we started to see TDs, local TDs, coming on air and doing their bits and pieces. I thought to myself, well, if the local TDs are getting involved and the councillors are coming in to do interviews and the guards are sending in notices about road closures, we must be doing something right. We covered every council meeting, and those meetings would be reported verbatim on the day. Ken Smith used to do that. If Ken wasn't available, myself, I often went to a few of them. But Ken was the man, and Ken would do those meetings verbatim, meticulously reported. And everybody at home, people before that never knew what a council meeting sounded like, now had every single word that every councillor said at the meeting the next day. And suddenly, councillors started to be held to account for their actions or what, any comments they might have made at a meeting. They were challenged about it. That was absolutely huge.
It wasn't just local politicians that were looking for exposure. Even Taoiseachs, such as Charlie Haughey, would take to the airwaves.
I did interview him briefly when he came to Yall, coming off a helicopter. We had a candidate here in Yall running for the Dáil at the time, and he came to Yall to promote the candidate. But I had others afterwards. You know, I had a few words with Garrett Fitzgerald as well. Very, very clever and intelligent man, as indeed was Haughey. We had a pile of politicians. We had television stars, we had radio, film stars came in to see us. You'd never think of those things. Like, we always had brilliant relationship with the government agencies, local council, the guards, civil authorities, no problem at all. Every one of them availed of the service. A typical example, we went to Middleton to do an outside broadcast at one stage. We were allowed plug in to the local courthouse in Middleton and utilise the electricity from the courthouse out onto our outside broadcast van. And not alone that, but the local sergeant in Middleton then came out to us when we were setting up and told us that the kettle would be on the boil inside in the station. If we needed to go in and have a cup of tea, there'd be no problem at all. We were more than welcome. That was the way they saw us as something that could be utilised to their own advantage. And they did.
We'll rise and follow Charlie. Hail the leader, hail the man. With freedom's cause it all.
Community Radio Yall was enjoying great success. It had a strong standing within the community and was making money. The station reached a stage where it had developed beyond its meagre beginnings. And whilst the Connolly family had been gracious hosts and firm supporters of the station, the ad hoc studio in the upstairs attic would have issues of its own. Yvonne Smith describes the entrance to Connolly's attic.
You had to hop over a gate, or sometimes the gate would be opened, depending on how we entered, or we went through the golf course, which we shouldn't have. And you came to this ladder, which was basically faced up to a hole in the wall. And actually, it was quite high. And you didn't really see the door. All you really saw was this black opening. And you went up this rickety ladder, holding on for dear life. I'm pretty sure, actually, it's the only time I've done that. Particularly a radio station up at the top of the ladder. It's like a Jack and the Beanstalk, where are you going, like here?
Jim Coleman describes the layout of the studio.
Did you ever see any of those films with Dr. Frankenstein? You was going to his laboratory. You could hear the pzzz, pzzz. That's what it was like up there. There was jam pots and bits of wire going into bottles and cubs. And I'll always remember to get the station on the air. There was one of those fluorescent tubes coming down at an angle. When you came in, you turned on the light and then you clicked this switch and this tube started flickering on and off, on and off, on and off. And you couldn't go on the air until it was actually lighting. And it could be flickering for 10 minutes or a quarter of an hour. And down at the end, it separated like it was like an atomic pile. Remember those old brass bedsteads? That was what kept the transmitter away from the rest of us. Oh, boys, oh, boys. You wonder how we ever got this far. Had a wonderful time, sir.
Noel Cronin.
The transmitter itself. I suppose nowadays we'd absolutely stare in horror and aghast at it, to tell you the truth, because the transmitter itself was about maybe 4,000 or 5,000 volts that anybody could stick their hand in and get boom. But that was the thinking at the time. Everybody was warned about it. For God's sake, don't put your hand in there. In the story, nowadays, that would be completely taboo. You know, you wouldn't even dream of something like that. But that was the thinking at the time. And most transmitters at the time were like that.
Eugene Crotty has volunteered with Community Radio Yall since 1979.
The roof was something else, be quite honest about it, because it was a galvanised roof. So when it started to rain, oh boy, that was just something, because you could hear the rain hopping off the galvanised and you had to talk like, and there was nothing you could do about it. And in the wintertime, it was freezing, like, especially if you came in and it was raining, you were wet to the skin and you just had to find a way of trying to dry yourself. And people now have been known now to do programs in their underwear and trying to dry their pants, so we won't mention any names about that.
But the makeshift studio provided many fond memories for the station's volunteers. Long-serving volunteer John Cunningham recalls one instance of feline interference.
I was up there one day and I had two people coming up. One fellow was playing a tin whistle and the other person was playing accordion. But we were inside anyway, and we were in the attic, as they call it, and there was a Morris Minor down at the bottom, belonging to the family. And there was a cat down there who had kittens, and we were working away grand anyway. Of course, it was mostly LPs at him, there was no CDs at him. Everything was going grand anyway, and the cat decided to come in without any permission, and the record was going one way, but he decided to go the other way, and you can imagine a cat up on top of a record, and his legs going this way. So it came, instead of it being 33, and I thought it was 45 sometimes. So he didn't apologise, he just went off his way. That was it.
The limited facilities also required a lot of creativity, as Noel Cronin recalls.
Ken Smith had a couple of members of the All Pipe Band in the studio. And Ken was doing an interview from the foundation of the Pipe Band, and Ken said, we're going to interrupt the programme now, sir, because we're going to have a number from the Y'all Pipe Band. And Ken walks over to the back door with the microphone, sticks it out the back door, and there, directly below us, was the rest of the Y'all Pipe Band playing on the number one tee in the Y'all Golf Course, playing away. And golfers, I'm sure, were looking, what in the name of goodness is going on here? Like, but to see the band up outside the back door of Eileen Connolly's playing.
By 1982, Community Radio Yall was enjoying great success, and the station was finally able to move into its own premises, situated above Frank Owen's pub next to Yall's Clock Gate. For Seamus Murphy, the new location in the heart of Yall Town was an important move for the station.
That brought us right into the heart of the community, because we were there, visible. Coming in and out, they saw myself and the other presenters going in and out. There were people coming up knocking on the door. They just wanted to have a look in to see, is that the guy behind the voice? That opened new horizons completely. It gave us a bit more leeway. It gave us a bit more confidence. People began to take us a bit more seriously because we had moved into relatively state-of-the-art premises. That was the making of the radio.
The new facilities impressed Eugene Crotty.
It felt like heaven to us because it was a new start. And when we went to Frank's, we started getting a little bit more professional. And there was new shows and you had more people getting involved. And, you know, people started to improve and we tried our best, I suppose, really. Everybody tried their best.
Politicians and celebrities would drop by the station on a regular basis, including one television presenter and his imaginary friend.
It was a guy called Pat Inglesby. He used to have a programme called Pat's Hat or Pat's Chat. It was a kids' programme. Now, this guy was... Well, I thought he was away with the birds anyway, because when he knocked on the door, he asked me could he come in, and I said, sure, of course you can. He said, I'm fierce interested in community radio. And he said, do you mind if I bring my friend in? So I looked out the hallway. I thought there might be somebody coming up the stairs behind him, but there wasn't. He had an imaginary turkey on a lead, and he brought the turkey, allegedly, in with him and sat him down and told him to be quiet. Well, oh, this is gospel. It is gospel. I am not joking. I do not jest at all.
Despite Pat Inglesby's invisible turkey, he gave Seamus Murphy an insight into how far Community Radio Yall had progressed.
I think he had visited at that stage about 30 radio stations throughout Ireland. Quite a few of them in Dublin, because there were lashings of them in Dublin at the time. He felt that we had a far better setup than a lot of the stations that he would have visited, the smaller stations. Now, he had been in the bigger stations like Nova and Sunshine and a few of those. They would have been state of the art at the time. But he said from the smaller stations, we would have been well ahead of the posse at the time with what we had. We were doing pretty well.
The move to Frank Irwin's would see a substantial investment in studio equipment. But it was difficult to purchase a commercial transmitter due to the restrictions on buying the equipment at the time.
We got in contact with a fella up in Drogheda, and he was telling us that the BBC at the time were renewing a lot of their transmitting equipment. And they had four transmitters up in Divis in Northern Ireland. So we decided to purchase one of these transmitters. There was three of us went up anyway, purchased the transmitter and put it into the van. Now, the transmitter itself, I suppose, weighed about 3/4 of a tonne. And of course, when we put it into the van, the exhaust was practically scraping the ground. So down we came with it anyway. And we actually drove down through Derry in the midst of the troubles with this thing. And the back of it was sticking out of the van. And we were stopped by the British Army. Here you had a Southern registered van, three shady looking characters inside in the front of it, this thing sticking out the back with all wires, and it looked the part, like. So we were stopped, and the guns were trained on us and saying, look, what are you doing? In fairly stern terms, like, and because we were basically frightened all of our wits. And I just told them, look, that this was actually a transmitter. So they got on the walkie-talkie to their superior. This chap came around the corner in a Jeep and he said, look, what seems to be the trouble? And we told him that this was a transmitter. We were purchased it up on the other side of Derry and we were bringing it down to the south. So in fairness, he said, look, he said, I have to say, it looks very suspicious. And we said, yeah, we kind of gathered it. And he said, it's something that we don't see every day, a Southern registered van bringing this thing down to the country. So he said, look, I'll tell you what I'll do is my lads will go out with you, out through the trouble spots, he says. So in fairness, they were helpful when they knew what we had. But I think I was wondering at the time, should I have a change of underpants? Literally, right? I think that I was absolutely terrified. But we are here to tell the tale, anyway.
With the developments in equipment, a central location in town, and the support of all sections of the community, the scene was set for Community Radio Yall's biggest programme as a pirate broadcaster, The Voice of Yall.
Reverend Father, ladies and gentlemen, good evening and welcome to the Castle Tower.
This evening we present the second semi-final in the Voice of Yall competition. And as you know, this competition is sponsored by the Murphy Heineken Brewers in Cork, in conjunction with the Vintners Federation of Ireland Yall Branch and Community Radio Yall.
Seamus Murphy is a former station manager of Community Radio Yall.
That was just probably one of the most defining programmes for COI in its history, and will remain so. It was an idea that Nooch had, and Nooch felt there was huge amounts of talent in the town, as there is, and they start listening to that talent and giving them a platform. And he would go to all the publicans, as many as he could, and ask them to get singers. And they did. And I think there was about 8 pubs or something got involved in the first year. And huge success. Really, really big success now. Recorded on the night, and we put it out as an hour and a half programme later on in the week.
This wonderful night I gazed at the grotto, a glowing light, a feeling divine swept over me, dear.
Nicky Parker volunteered with Community Radio Yall from 1979 to 1985 and was a contestant in The Voice of Yall.
That was like Dallas every week. You had to listen to The Voice of Yall. If you couldn't get into the pub every Monday night, it would be in a pub filled to capacity. It would be the talking point leading up to it, and it could be the talking point for the next week. Such a fella got through, and she shouldn't have got through, or he shouldn't have got through. Like, and everybody would bring their own following. Like, there would be jeers and cheers before it even start. So everybody with their own their tribal following. It was as big as you're getting, y'all, at the time.
The first year it started out, it was relatively light-hearted, you know. The next year then it started to get very, very serious because the publicans started to take it really, really, really serious. And then suddenly they started getting in singers from out of town and singers coming in from Cork and places like that, down especially for to represent their, I wouldn't say their local, but their chosen public. So that's how serious it got.
Return to me when springtime comes around.
At the height of its success, The Voice of Yall would run for 6 months of the year on Monday nights, packing out pubs across Yall Town and the surrounding rural areas. Noel Cronin was the man in charge of recording the competition.
One of the semi-finals, I think, was held up in Minis in the Yew Tree. And the seats were actually pre-booked. You had to book your seat before, and you couldn't get in there. The final was held below on the Wall Rally, and was so successful that we actually had to put speakers in different rooms to accommodate the crowd. Willie Manius came along, I think, for a couple of the finals, actually. He put televisions and a video camera into one so that the people could see it in other rooms. It was that successful.
Radio Yall was flying high, but its days were numbered. The government had finally decided to address the pirate radio problem. Over 200 pirate stations operated around the country. The introduction of legal licensed stations was on the horizon, and if a station wanted a license, they'd have to stop broadcasting by the end of 1988. If they were to continue, severe penalties were waiting for them. Seamus Murphy was station manager at the time.
It was made easy for us in the end. We got a copy of the legislation, and basically what it showed was there was a fine of £10,000 and anything up to 3 years in jail. This threw a whole new light on our outlook toward broadcasting. And we made a conscious decision, look, no, it's just not worth it. We just have to bite the bullet and close down. We kind of weaned the public into it as we were going along. But we took a conscious decision and we closed down. It was painful at the time.
Everybody said, God, look, there's a smart station down there in Yall, and what they're doing is quite novel and quite unique. They're not playing wall-to-wall music. They're just a community looking at itself. And I remember speaking to a chap.
Community Radio Yall's final broadcast as a pirate would take place on the 31st of December 1988.
Leading up to 12 o'clock, I was up in the studio and there was tears there as well. Like, I made contact with Noel and we had a chat over the phone. We just kind of reminisced about old times. We thanked the people of Yall for their contribution and their support. Without them, we wouldn't have been where we were. And we said our goodbyes and that was it. And I had the dubious pleasure, if you like, of being the last voice to be heard on the old station. It doesn't please me, but it had to be done.
We don't know a thing about at the moment, but I have no doubt that the 9.5 years we spent weren't wasted. As said, once again, thank you, God bless, and goodbye. And I'd like to take this opportunity of wishing you all the best in 1989. Goodbye, and God bless. Thank you again.
Thank you very much, Noel. And that's it. From all of us here at COY, have a very happy new year.
I'm returned, I'll find a way to for me.
Eugene Crotty and Seamus Murphy mourned the loss of the station that they had been with since 1979.
It was part of your life, and from the 1st of January, you had to change your routine and you wonder what the hell are you going to do now? Like, something was taken away from you. And it took a while to actually get used of not turning on CRY, listening to the programs you wanted to listen to, you know, and there was a void in the town. No matter how good or bad the station was at the time, a lot of people did miss it.
It was a huge chapter in my life. Something that I would never have imagined that I could have done originally. And I'm sure a lot of the other presenters must have felt the same, that they would never have imagined they could have done anything like they had done for the last few years. So it was tinged with sadness. In a way, a kind of an inner relief that we weren't going to be caught. But the day after was just unbelievable. It was just so empty. You know, what the hell are we going to do now?
Community Radio Yall would return to the airwaves as a legal licensed station in 1995. But that's another story.
It is remarkable that it has survived 40 years. I think it's hard to beat the content of what's in CRY on a daily basis. I'm proud of the fact that I played a tiny part in it. But the big thing is that it's here, and it's due to the work of so many volunteers, too many to mention. The progress that CRY has made has been truly outstanding, astounding, and long may it last.
Across the evening sky, all the birds are leaving.
I think it was great. I'm glad I did it. No regrets. We were doing the right thing. We were reflecting the life of the community. And we were providing entertainment for all ages. And I think it'd be hard to stop that.
Before the winter fire.
I don't think I'd change anything. I wouldn't. I really wouldn't. Because I met some wonderful people. I've been privileged to have a laugh and a joke and a crack, and 'twas brilliant.
I have no thought of time. For who knows where the time goes? Who knows where?
We've had bad times, we've had good times, we've had tearing one's hair out times, and I've often said to myself, what in the name of the good God did I get myself involved in this thing for? But it's been worthwhile for me. I'm so proud to be involved
with community radio as it is today. And indeed, the team that have went before us in the pilot days, they have paved the way for what we have now.
And I'm not alone. While my love is near me, I know it will be so. Until it's time to go,
USA is a Community Radio Yall production. This programme was funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with a television licence fee.